Thanks for listening to the Adam Carolla Show on Podcast One.
Well, we got a great show going today. NASCAR great Michael Waltrip calling in. I know you're going, huh? Oh, no. His story. Crazy, man. Your mind will be blown when I tell you about him and Dale Earnhardt and everything else. So that's in the first half. First, LifeLock. Cyber criminals stole 700,000 customer records from a major hotel chain containing customer names, emails, addresses, phone numbers, and then the scammers. They use that information, your personal information, when they're trying to get more and they're trying to ring your bank account and rob it. So they use your info and they use your details and then they steal even more. So many ways cyber criminals can take what's yours. Don't let it happen. LifeLock. LifeLock identity theft protection adds the power of Norton Security. Help protect against threats to your devices you can't easily see or fix on your own. If there's a problem, their agents will work to fix it, but you won't have a problem because they're LifeLock. Come on now, protect yourself with LifeLock, right, Dawson?
No one can prevent all identity theft or cybercrime or monitor transactions at all businesses, but LifeLock with Norton Security can see threats you might miss on your own. Go to LifeLock.com or call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code Adam for 10% off your first year. That's promo code Adam at LifeLock.com or 1-800-LIFELOCK for 10% off.
Support for the Adam Carolla podcast comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Imagine how it feels to have an award-winning team by your side through every step of the mortgage process. That's exactly what you get with Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Rocket Mortgage does more to help you understand the home buying process so you can get exactly what you need. They've helped millions of Americans achieve their dream of home ownership. When you're ready to purchase your home, and the home of your dreams, they can help you as well. J.D. Power has ranked Quicken Loans highest in customer satisfaction for primary mortgage origination 9 years in a row and highest in mortgage servicing 6 years in a row. When you work with them, you get more than just a loan because Rocket Mortgage is more than just a lender. Right, Dawson?
Get started online at rocketmortgage.com/Adam. For J.D. Power award information, visit jdpower.com. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS, consumeraccess.org, number 3030. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Push button, get mortgage. From Carolla One Studios in Glendale, California, this is the Adam Carolla Show. Adam's guest today, author and former NFL safety, Bo Eason. With Gina Grad on news, Bald Brian on sound effects, a phone call from NASCAR racer Michael Waltrip, plus RJ Bell calls in with his NFL picks, and now, preparing for the Baldwin roast by yelling at Natalia on voicemail and not talking to his sibling, Adam Carolla.
Yeah, get it on. Got to get it on. No choice but to get on a mandate. You get it on, man. Thanks for tuning in. Thanks for sharing. Saw the ratings. They went up because you people share. We don't do outdoor advertising. Good day, Gina Grad.
Good day to you.
And Ball Brian.
No.
I am excited about most of our guests today. Michael Waltrip. Well, first off.
Who's the odd man out?
This is a, I won't say.
I don't want to, they know.
It'll be clear by the end of the show.
Yeah. I watched Blink of an Eye, the doc. It's really, I mean, you want to talk about a crazy story. Michael Waltrip, his brother is probably more famous. Darrell Waltrip is a NASCAR kind of legend from 80s and 90s, probably before. Michael is this kind of funny, unassuming kind of guy. Who was a good race car driver, but he had gone 462 races without a win. Ooh. Then the biggest race of the year is the Daytona 500. He then gets basically befriended by Dale Earnhardt, and Dale Earnhardt believes in him. He's like, you've lost 462 races. You didn't lose, but you didn't win.
Come in first.
And 462 starts. That's a lot of races.
He's the Gina Gretta of Rotten Tomatoes game.
That's right. How dare you? I had a number five for 3 weeks, really Brian. Right.
Hold on. Somebody believed in him. So there's a little chasm.
The analogy isn't perfect.
This is not the day where I can take this kind of ribbing. It's just not.
So I want to hear about your trials and tribulations because somebody tweeted me a funny rich man, poor man, too. But Dale Earnhardt believes in him. And Dale's the intimidator, and Dale's doing all the winning. And Dale says, I want you to drive for my team. So he becomes a team member for Dale Earnhardt.
Earnhardt likes what he sees in the kid or something? Like, obviously, he's not like his results, but he can see he can drive or something?
He knows he can drive. I think the feeling is if he had the right equipment, maybe he could win. Then, on the biggest race of the year, Michael Waltrip wins the Daytona 500 with Dale Earnhardt behind him, obviously, as his teammate. I don't know, and our internet's down,
just
and I can't remember, or just came back. I don't know if it was the last lap or close to the end of the race. There's an accident. Dale Earnhardt is involved with the accident. Michael Waltrip is up on the podium in winner's circle for the first time ever with the biggest win of his career and the biggest win. I mean, talk about your first win.
Right.
You know, winning a Talladega would be fine, but winning the Daytona 500, the biggest on the year schedule, it's the biggest race. Mm-hmm. You win, you're up on the podium, and some guy is whispering in your ear, Dale's dead.
Oh, that was the accident.
Oh, my
yes.
God. Uh-huh.
Which is like, what the?
Jesus.
You're standing up on this podium getting ready to spray champagne.
Oh.
And now
that's a muted celebration.
They're saying it's bad. Like they're saying, Dale Earnhardt, it's bad, is basically what they're telling him, like up on the podium. Was it on the last lap or almost the last lap or something like that?
It was like, the very end of the race. Let me double check. But I do remember in the documentary that he's coming to promote Blink of an Eye, he does talk about that in the first 5 minutes about having to hear that on the podium. It's the happiest day of his life. And then it just comes crashing down with that news.
Jesus.
What a final lap. The final lap. The excitement of being in that car and winning the Daytona 500 to your teammate and buddy. Like the guy you go fishing with and hang out on the boat during the off season, the guy believed in you, is dead on that lap. Like it didn't happen in the middle. You know, sometimes shit happens in the middle of the race and they have to clean it all up and they have to airlift somebody out or whatever. And you kind of process it and then you put it behind. It's like, all right, time to get back in the car. We got to go to work. Like, you know, he's going to the hospital, Godspeed. Now we got to get back in the car and finish this race. But literally, this is happening behind him when he's winning the race.
Brutal.
Jesus Christ. What a crazy story, right? Anyway.
That's what the doc's about?
Not about that, but
his relationship with.
Yeah, and that and everything else. Anyway, it's a really strong doc. So we'll talk to Michael about it when he calls in. We've been having internet issues.
What?
/ phone issues. So hopefully
all the time.
I will say it's funny. I walked over for a rare time. I walked over to the other shop. I got here early, and the internet was down too at the exact same time. They're just sitting around on their phones, you know, doing emails and stuff. You know,
it's the neighborhood.
And they're like, yeah, internet's down.
Yeah. Now, not only is the internet down, but it is nutty Africa hot, as they would say,
it's warm
out here, and it's a rare humidity.
Yeah.
With the heat, which we don't normally experience in SoCal. So it's extra super miserable.
How are things at your house, Gina?
Yeah, I wouldn't know. So our air conditioner went out again. The real reason
you
I wanted this house.
Central air?
Yeah, that's why I wanted this house was because it had the Nest system and it has the central air. And we were going to be just fine with this new valley life of ours. And it went out on Sunday over Labor Day weekend, and the guy came out on Monday, 2 hours later, said, oh, yeah, no, this whole unit needs to be replaced. And we said, that sounds great. So called yesterday. The very, very nice woman that I spoke to on the phone to, you know, fix the air conditioner, I said, well, do you know when we should expect someone? No, I really don't. Okay, well, I just wanted to double check because we got a little one, and, you know, we bumped up against possible taking him to urgent care. I I don't know, was her answer to me. So everything was going great. And finally, by last night, it was 96 in our house. Mm. And
so says the Nest.
So says the Nest and the little child monitor.
Right.
And we have the it's like a Kansas Tableau. Fans, doors, got the box fan in the window, old
right.
school, just yeah. laying there holding ice packs. And we said, this is insane. We got to go to a hotel. So in the middle of the night, as though I was stealing this child who looks nothing like me, I pick up the little 4-year-old and we make a grocery store run and we get to the hotel and then Andy meets us there and it's chaos. It's insane right now.
It's a story.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll
end just up, was.
No, not for you, but the kid will have a story.
Oh, that was the best night of his life, bouncing back and forth between the beds, asking if we moved. If that's where we live now.
I had somebody tweeted me a funny rich man, poor man, which is true. As you guys know, it's well documented. I get depressed when it gets hot because of what I was exposed to.
Yeah, yeah, sense memory.
Triggering.
And I had, I would say, one of the worst air conditioning runs ever. Like, I mean, if you were to, in the modern era,
right.
obviously we're not talking about pilgrims. But if you were just to kind of take a look at my, what would be my history with air conditioning.
It's fraught.
You take a look at it.
Checkered past.
I would defy anyone in the modern era to have a worse air conditioning relationship with than I. The rich man, poor man joke that was funny was, as I told you guys, my mom's house. Well, hold on a second. My mom's house had one air conditioner, and it was in my stepdad's room, which
right.
was also the den, which we'd sit on his bed and watch TV while the air conditioning would run. And
crank
then for
it.
Some reason, we'd leave, and then he'd sleep on the bed. Which
that's what they're designed for, right?
I don't know. Stay get bed. A fucking sofa. Like, are you guys as amazed by adults as I am? Like, first off, my family's so fucking lucky I wasn't my age when they were my age, because I would have just stood in that fucking den and went, what the fuck is wrong with all of you people? This is insane.
Shame
this is insane. Get a fucking sofa and turn some air on. And you sleep on a bed, and I don't fucking sleep on a service porch. There's no goddamn insulation in there. Fucking room's an oven.
You know,
what are you doing?
Your question about are amazed by adults made me think, like, are you aware of this sort of, people are less adults than they used to be somehow, because
yes.
now that like people like talk about adulting, like
yeah.
that's a thing. Are you aware of this? Like
there's
like,
adulting like, classes we've
but,
talked about.
But
them.
like yeah, that, and also it came out of this like social media thing. It's like, oh, I adulted so hard today. I applied for a credit card and I went to the bank. Or just
I don't
these
want
things,
to adult today.
Yeah, these things that are so you're like
basic.
That's just what people do, and it's like I did some real adulting today.
Weird.
You're a grown man.
Oh. As I've always said, we got to pray another fucking world war doesn't break out, because we are fucked.
We'll need to get adulting fast.
Right.
Yeah.
So I had the house I grew up in had the one in my stepdad's room. Mm-hmm. But of course, I was on the service porch and there was no fan or ceiling fan or anything. So that was out. The rich man, poor man joke, which was funny that somebody sent me, was later on when my mom decided to live a little.
Cut loose.
She literally had a unit in my stepdad's room,
mm-hmm.
and then she had a unit in her room.
Ooh la la.
Make a noise. Let's see if we can tally these. One in my step. Now, mind you, the house is 900 square feet and was bulldozed after she sold it. But one in stepdad's room.
Number one.
One in her room.
Number two.
These are bad, used, shaky
rickety.
Window mount units that have the weird accordion
yep.
thing to make up the gap so
mm-hmm.
it's not open to the outside. One in the kitchen.
Number three.
One in the old room that I used to have to fucking sleep in.
Number four.
And a fifth unit in the living room in the window. Five window mounted units.
Later, hosen.
And when I say 900 square feet, I mean it could have been 865. Like, worth of footprint of a house. Now, the thing that was funny that somebody tweeted me is rich man, poor man, zoned air conditioning.
Number 182.
I live in a house that has four zones, right. But my mom has five zones, technically.
Right. Who's doing better?
Yeah.
If that's what we're going by.
That's funny. Think about that.
That's great.
Literally zones.
Yeah.
But they're in a window.
What are the odds she would let more than one run at a time?
Oh, man, that's tough. I imagine if John was in his room. Well, on a dog day night, you know, she had to go to her room and he had to go to his room. They had to run it. But then I went from that house to an apartment on Laurel, no air from my dad. And then the worst, which my dad's A-frame house where I had to sleep up in the attic and there was no fan and no air and no anything in there. All the while, no one's car has air conditioning.
Oh, sure.
So there is no air conditioning.
You can't escape to
that. Mobile escape.
In cars. Yeah. Later on, moved out to a garage. This is all in the valley.
Right.
The garage had no air, no ceiling fan, no none of that. Later, moved from the garage to my first apartment, which was upstairs, facing the west, on Laurel Canyon, with no tree or shade in front of it, and no window mount unit, or no air of any kind. Just a 40s building upstairs.
Yeah,
I got it. I'll tell you guys something, man.
No oxygen in there.
If you can... my mom's house and my dad's house were just sitting in the middle of nothing with no trees and no anything. My grandparents' house had like a big elm tree in front, and the house was sort of behind it, and it sort of cast a shadow on the house when the sun would start going down. It was much more comfortable in their house.
Yeah.
You go upstairs into apartment, you're screwed. Mm-hmm. You do the lead apartment, the front-facing apartment, and it's facing the west, and there's nothing but Laurel Canyon in front of you and no trees. It is a sweat box up there. Then I go into the mini truck, the 79 Mazda or Datsun Mini. Nothing there. Then I just go to Chatsworth to work on people's houses.
Ugh.
It was just
ironically
like,
installing AC.
No, I was just I'd either work outside or I would work in a industrial warehouse in San Francisco. San Fernando Valley. It was in Chatsworth that had no air, no swamp.
Go. How many years did you put together with nothing to look forward to?
Oh, my entire life. Like, the people tell me all the time.
And
like,
counting.
I mean, really like, why'd you get into comedy? I said, I was fucking miserable. And they're like, yeah, but you have this gift or this love or this, I've got to sing, you know, I'm not alive unless I'm dancing. I was like, no, I was so fucking miserable that I was like, I got to get a car with air conditioning.
Yeah.
Like, there was a misery index. I went from that apartment upstairs.
Oh, there's more.
To a miniature house that was literally just across the street. It was the same thing that you're doing. So it's a small house in the San Fernando Valley. No air. No window, no wall, no nothing. I then moved into someone's room. Joyce Lawfer's house.
Did you ask?
Her kid,
hey, what are you doing here?
Oh, wasn't she the one in Hebrew Heights?
Yeah, her kid went off to college, and so the room was vacant. She was just a single mom. Mm-hmm. So I moved into that room for about 3 months, had a little air. Moved into another house that was sold out from under us. Didn't have the air in that. Moved into a small apartment in North Hollywood. Did have air, central air. That was about eight months or a year, then moved to Santa Monica, no air, but didn't really need it.
Yeah.
Ocean breeze.
But it was about 5 days out of the year that you kind of needed it. You just sucked it up. Then moved into a house with Ralph and Cortland and La Crescenta, another freestanding house, no central air, just sucked it up with that. But I found that if you have no air, but you do have a swimming pool, you can make it. And that was a lot of jumping into the pool, jumping right out. Literally wouldn't even dry myself. Just lay down on top of my bed, turn a fan on.
Well, that's you've told a lot of sad stories about your life. Congratulations. But
thank
something
you.
That sticks out at me for some reason as the saddest is having to sneak into a neighbor's pool and dip yourself in so quietly, just
so as not to make a splash,
as not to die in the night and not to wake anyone up. That is probably the saddest thing I've ever heard.
Well, my garage I was living in was probably hotter at 1 a.m. than it was at
and my people have been through a lot.
8 p.m.
Yeah,
it was brutal. I couldn't sleep. Also, this should also be under the heading of I run hot. I don't like the heat.
Right. Yeah.
There are people that are just naturally don't have a problem with it. It actually exacerbates the problem when I lived in that apartment that was a sweatbox upstairs. My roommate was Donnie. We slept on the same futon. There was one bedroom. We had a futon. Donnie would just go to bed. He'd just go to sleep. And I'd be like, oh, God, oh, God. And I'd be going in the shower, yep, and like turning the fan on and stuff. He just didn't, like, he would just go. I don't sweat. He's never sweat. And he's like, it doesn't bother me. Mm-hmm. Like, I'd see him out, like, working on his car on a day like this. Right. He'd be wearing, like, jeans and a jean jacket.
No.
And I'd be like, you're under the hood. I'd be under the hood. The sweat would just be dripping off of my nose. You know, my hair would be wet from that. He's like, I don't have a problem. So it's like, the only thing that makes it worse is when you actually have someone who doesn't care.
Someone
like,
there.
Like, I don't care. I'm like, we got to get air conditioning. He's like, or not. I'm fine. So it was brutal. And yes, I would obviously have to get up. It was about a 6 foot high cinder block wall, which is good. I didn't make any noise going over the top of it. I still can remember it. Like, it had that weird red cap on it, like the cinder blocky, like sort of decorative. It had a sort of block cap. You know, like you'd look at a wall and there'd be block, 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 and then the top had a 2-inch thick sort of red brick colored kind of cap. But it was super scratchy, right? Because it was like cinder blocky outdoor
Pumice-y
stuff. And I was naked. So I'd have to go over it.
Can't believe you're not on a registered list.
I'd have to lower myself down. We could probably, I don't know if the internet works, Maxipata, but if you go to 11752 Hartsook Street, you'll see that backyard. You'll see the neighbor's yard. You'll see the pool there. Yeah. And I would just
Google Earth.
I jump over. And like I said, it always struck me how loud water is when you don't realize it's loud.
Yeah.
And I would just, I think I held on to the diving board and I just
lowered myself
as quietly as I could lower. And then I would hold myself underwater as long as I could hold underwater. And then I would get out and it had the rail and the steps thing. Oh. But when you got out, it kind of made noise.
Yeah,
like
splashy.
It was kind of weird. And then I'd have to go over the fence.
You're a reverse machine in Apocalypse Now.
Yes.
Just slowly going down to the water.
That's right. Those are the salad days. I also was back during the glory days when I'd come home from construction and I was so covered with everything and I'd be locked out of the house and I would just shower with the hose. Wow. There was a hose bib by my garage. It was it was quite an upbringing. Now later, I remodeled that house,
and I
put a swimming pool in it.
Is that the pool?
We did the show, the thing that's funny is when we did the show, I don't know, whatever, Adam Carolla and
2005.
Friends remodel your home or whatever.
Wait, this is the TLC live show?
Yeah, no, this is, this is 15 years ago.
So this would have been 2005.
Right.
The Adam Carolla Project.
The Adam Carolla Project. That show. People like that show.
It was a good show.
It was a good show. When we did that show, we put a pool in. Now, we're looking at it from Google Earth map, whatever. But if you go down a little bit, you will see that I was surrounded to my right, to my left, and behind me by swimming pools.
You really were?
So
big ones.
Everywhere.
I would sit in the garage and just hear, Marco Polo!
Splashing.
We were the only fucking house that didn't have a pool. And the pool to the right is the house in the yard. And we put a hedge up there and remodeled it. But I think it still has a diving board. It looks like it.
The one house that still has a diving board.
And I would just go over that fence. I would lower myself into the pool. I would jump back over the fence and then go into the garage, which is the building on the the right there. And that was that was my move.
Did you guys so – my parents never had air conditioning. I didn't have air conditioning until Christy and I bought our house. Did you guys live in a world of box fans?
Oh,
box,
yeah. That's,
box fans were – that was my most valuable possession.
You put box fans in windows
in the window,
at night.
Yeah, at night. It would blow
box
the
box fans are awesome because it's like here – I had two worlds. The box fan is great, but it's like if you turn it on high, it'll fall over.
That's true. Like,
I don't know why.
Still true.
It needs footing.
Nobody invented a foot for a box fan. They're
a
like,
fan stand.
We're going to take this thing. It's going to be 4 inches wide, and it's going to be 29 inches tall, and then when you turn it on, it'll fall over.
Adam, so by the time you got money and ditched the box fan life, I was still living the box fan life, and they made footings, little pieces of plastic.
I know. They were like bust off or something.
They would. And yes, my roommate would move it to another window, depending on where the sun was, and of course the footing would come off. And then it became this search for this 30-cent item. Hey, where's the footing? Where's the footing for the fan? Where's the...
There's two things.
Miserable!
There was the box fan that would always fall over, and there was the space heater that would start... It had like a resonant frequency harmonic imbalance or something. Like at some point in the middle of the night, it just start going, and you have to pop it. Like you'd punch the top of it, and like it'd mellow out for a minute, but then it would spaz out again. I don't know what it was. It was just like the wire coils
in the sheet. Mobile ones.
It was like in the sheet metal, which made like an echo chamber, and it would start spazzing out at some point, and you'd have to punch it to knock it back down.
Like the bridge that would wobble because of the sound.
Yeah, that
sound
was
waves.
In
Seattle?
Tacoma or Seattle? Something. Yeah,
like Washington.
Yeah, resin frequency. But the point is, here's the thing. Being poor is a big fucking calorie burner because you're having to constantly like move stuff around and do stuff
adjust.
And plug stuff and go get the fan from the thing and put it in the thing and the window's open. I'm not sleeping with the window unlocked. Well, I'm not. It's too hot in here. Not. It's like it's such a fucking time suck. So I was just like, God damn. So I was well into my adult life with no air. Eventually, I stepped up to an Isuzu Trooper with no air. But again, when your house has no air or your apartment has no air, your truck has no air, and then you go to a job with no air, it's just 24/7 no air. So when this kind of weather kicks in, it just crushes you. It's assault. And also, doing earthquake rehab work in this weather is brutal. Also, there's also stupid things we never thought of, like the I always talk about like the urinal, right? The urinal, the porta potty, it took them 80 years to figure out to put the little plastic urinal on the side, pop rivet it in there, and put 3 foot of garden hose that led into the main hopper. Before that, everyone was just pissing into this pot of shit being grossed out, right? I don't know what took so long. When you see guys working now, guys doing road work or outdoor work or even up on a roof or something, they have those pop-up umbrellas. Yeah. They have those pop-ups.
Right.
That didn't exist. So the deal is if you had to get up on the roof, you just had to work on the roof.
You just
bake. If you had to work out, I worked a jackhammer, like out on the sidewalk. You just stand there. And someone would be like, take a towel, dunk it in the toilet, put the towel on your head, you know, take a hat. Take two baseball hats, put them on like Sherlock Holmes, and it was like, or somebody could. We had umbrellas. Yeah. Like nobody I ever worked with had an umbrella.
Oh
like
God.
Nobody. Now you go down to Home Depot for $19, you get one of these 6 foot by 6 foot pop ups, or I don't know what they call them. You just fold them out and pop them, and then you do your work on the sidewalk, but you're in the goddamn shade. At least.
Figure it out.
No, you just bake out there.
You know what? I feel better.
Enjoy your evening in your fancy hotel.
Bo Eason, I'm excited to talk to. He's a motivational guy and an ex-NFLer. Dr. Drew, and you tell me when Michael pops up.
We might be on the phone with him now. Chris is just giving him a call.
Okay. Gary, Dr. Drew, this thing about... we'll see if he pops up, and I might have to start complaining about Dr. Drew. Dr. Drew, I've always had this relationship where we split the money, but I do 80% of the work. That's basically been our entire relationship.
It works out well, yeah.
And, like, just this, 10 years of Loveline. If I didn't come in if I was doing Letterman or something or whatever, just couldn't come in, sick, whatever, we'd run a best of.
Mm-hmm.
If he couldn't come in, I had to come in and deal with Dr. Spaz or Dr. whoever, Vinnie Bumbatz, and had to get through a show with a guy who didn't know how to broadcast,
right.
essentially. So when he would go off, like, hey, I'm going to New York to sell Trojan condoms, I'd go, fine, but I would still have to come in. That alone, not to mention the live shows. Jesus Christ. I mean, I have to tell
all
the jokes.
Or, shows,
yeah,
and...
do all that. I think
what well, hey, dispense advice, I think medical Drew, advice.
Drew's hit some new heights or new lows. I'll share that with you in a minute. Michael Waltrip is on the phone. Michael,
hello.
Can you hear me?
I hear you fine. Can you hear me? Over.
I can. wonderful job on Blink of an Eye. Very moving and a heartfelt documentary. So congratulations.
Well, I really appreciate that. I obviously, it's my life. I live it every day. It's a tough period to talk about, but it doesn't make it go away if you don't talk about it. I grew up in a family of five children. I was the fifth of five, and when I came along, I think my parents were kind of over kids, and so if I skint my leg, they'd be like, you'll be all right. You'll get over it. Just move on. And I hadn't talked a whole lot about what happened in February of 2001, and the book I wrote back in 2011 made the New York Times bestseller list and was really well received, and the documentary seems to be heading in a great direction too. So instead of not talking about your problems, I recommend, you know, finding a buddy or finding an outlet and talk about them, and it'll help you deal with it.
So you were literally on the podium at the Daytona 500 ready to celebrate and celebrating when this news was whispered into your ear?
Yeah, that was a crazy day. I took the checkered flag, and Adam, when you do you take the checker, obviously there's a cool down lap and you come back to victory lane. And in turn four, there'd been a wreck that Dale was involved in, and so his car was sitting on the infield grass along with Kenny Schrader and a couple others. And when I drove by there, I mean, I'm a Christian guy. I believe in heaven. I believe in angels. I just think for some reason I didn't even notice. I didn't even see there was anything. You know, it was my buddy. It was my friend. It was my car owner. But more, it was my friend. And if I'd have seen Dale's car over there, that I would have driven straight to him, you know, and jumped out and said, we won the race. And instead, I just motored right by, went to victory lane, celebrated with my team, my family, champagne and confetti, and I kept looking over my shoulder at the gate to victory lane and asking my friends, why is Dale not here yet? Where's Dale? And they said, oh, he's in that wreck. I'm sure he's fine. He'll get out of the hospital. You know, he'll get out of the infield care center, and he'll be here. And I kept looking, and Dale never came through the gate. Dale Jr. never came, and I was beginning to be curious and wondering why. And then my buddy, Kenny Schrader, he was in the wreck with Dale, and he came through the gate, and I was so happy because I'm like, finally, you know, somebody who's out there with me is here to tell me congratulations and give me a hug. And when Kenny walked up, he had just a somber look on his face, and we were great buds, and he would joke with me a lot about not ever winning. And when he looked at me with that look, I thought he was being a smartass again. You know, and I said, Schrader, it ain't that bad. I won the Daytona 500, is it? And he said, no, it's not good. It's just not good. And I said, what do you mean? He said, Dale's not good. I just want you to know that. And then he walked out, and, you know, there's there's a couple of photos. There's a video in the doc of Kenny delivering that news to me.
Yeah, kind of whispering in your ear.
A couple of photos of me sitting in victory lane on with my hands and my head in my hands, just wondering what the heck could be. And it wasn't long after that I got the news that Dale had been killed there on that last turn, the last lap.
Last turn, last lap. And Dale was, he was dead inside of the car, right?
Yeah.
He didn't die at the hospital.
Yeah, Kenny saying he wasn't good meant, you know, that it was really bad. And, you know, he evidently died instantly.
Yeah. It's so when you see the crash, it doesn't look like that much. The thing, I mean, it doesn't look horrific. The thing we were talking
about.
Well, sorry.
Go ahead.
Well,
the thing about the cars is that was a real dangerous time in our sport. And he was the fourth driver in less than a year that had gotten killed in a NASCAR wreck. And safety improvements to the cars and the Hans device for the driver and the safer barriers on the walls, all that was in the works, but it just didn't get there in time to save Dale. And I have, it's just science. And I'll tell you what happened over the years. We used to race these big old stock cars, you know, and they were big and heavy and floppy. They weren't engineered out near to the point where we were getting in the late 90s and into 2001. If a car if it flexes in those bank turns, 3,400 pounds, and it moves around, it's not going to handle consistently, and it's not going to handle properly. And the engineering wasn't even really a part of NASCAR till the 90s. And the engineers had learned if you stiffen these cars up, they'll go faster, they'll handle better, they'll take care of the tires better. Stiffer, stiffer, stiffer is faster and it's better. Well, when you do that, when there's an impact, where's all that energy that was being dissipated by that floppy car? Where does that energy immediately go? I mean, the only place it can is to the driver. So the hits were much harder. And even though it looked fairly benign, as far as NASCAR crashes go, and I've had a few that looked a lot worse, just the angle of the impact and getting hit by a second car when he was into the wall, and factor that in with the technology, the science of the cars, it was just a very, very hard, heavy hit.
Well, I was speaking literally yesterday, and I have two thoughts on this. I have interviewed the doctor who invented the safer barrier, and since Dale's crash, they've had no fatalities in NASCAR because they basically figured out that, hey, this barrier's got to give. Mm-hmm. It can't just be solid concrete. And I've spoken to this engineer. Max Pat will figure out his name. He's from the University of Indiana.
Dean Sicking.
Dean Sicking. Good call. Dean Sicking.
Dr. Dean Sicking.
Dr. Dean. And he also invents all those, you know, trash cans filled with sand that mm-hmm. are in front of the freeway overpass right. barrier so you don't hit the pylon. Like right. the whole deal is stuff has to give.
Right.
And when I was talking yesterday to Neil deGrasse Tyson, who's probably not a huge name on the NASCAR scene, but he said
about physics.
He was literally explaining, just he didn't know Michael was on the following day or anything. He said, you see these horrific crashes where the cars roll and roll and slide and get airborne and roll and roll. And he said, those guys get out of the car. He said, it's the ones that stop immediately, like Dale Earnhardt. Yeah. He said, those are the ones you got to look out for.
Yeah, he said, it's not the acceleration, it's the deacceleration.
The deceleration.
Deceleration.
Yeah. Right. And the crazy, horrific ones where the guys covering 500 feet.
Right. Rolling to a stop.
Rolling to a stop. So we were literally just on this subject, Michael.
That's a great example of it for sure. And another example that has a better ending is if you want to YouTube or Google Michael Waltrip Bristol 1990 crash. I hit a guardrail that gave way, and I hit the end of a concrete wall. And I literally went from probably 100 miles an hour to zero within a couple of seconds. And you think, well, that's the ones that hurt. And if you watch this, the reason why I didn't get hurt, and I think that it just wasn't my day, but the car blew up. I mean, it ripped apart, and so the energy went in that direction, and there me. So a couple of accidents, sales, where it doesn't look that full in mine, did, obviously, tragically, results.
The car is that's chronicled in the documentary, A Blink of an Eye, and the car is just destroyed. Like, you see the car, and you look at the car we're looking at now, and you see what's left of the car, you're like, who, if there's anyone in that car, they're dead. I've you've not seen a NASCAR destroyed like you've seen that car destroyed.
It doesn't even resemble a car anymore.
And also, Michael, you're a tall guy. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
you know, Kevin Hart can duck. another big NASCAR name.
Yeah, big sure. On the circuit. Yeah.
It is it's a moving documentary. It's a well-crafted documentary. I will tell you, and it was directed by Paul Tabliib. How do we say that?
Yes, sir.
And he did a 30 for 30 on the Hawaiian, the legend of Eddie Ackerman. I guess it's a cow. A cow.
Eddie would go.
It's good.
Yeah.
These poor names.
Yeah, I know. Anyway, I will tell you, as someone who makes automotive documentaries, and most of them look like bootleg porn, like it's just...
You think it's not good?
Well, look, the guys who like cars aren't good at crafting films or narratives. So the guys who make, like, a lot of the docs I've seen are like, I love the cars, but this is not a good piece of work. This is a good piece of work. This is, and I don't even know if you call it a car doc, but either way, it is a well-crafted piece.
I think it's more about friendship, having a buddy that believes in you, and just relationships as much as it is. And it's told in the setting of a NASCAR environment, but it's more about the people, more about, you know, me trying to figure out, when my big brother wouldn't really help me get going, me trying to figure out how I was going to get there. I knew I was going to get there, I just didn't know how. And then after all those losses, how I was going to ever win, and Dale's belief in me. And one of the best compliments I received about the documentary is Dale Jr. and his sister Kelly. They said, you know, we want our kids, when they grow up, to watch this so they can learn about their grandpa.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's touching for me, because I cared what two people thought, basically. I mean, my ex-wife, who was my wife at the time, she lived it, so she would understand the validity of everything that was said, and how original and correct it was, and she loved it. And then Dale and the Earnhardt, you know, how Dale Jr. felt about the movie, and that was their comments. And, you know, when you make something like this, it's personal. It's emotional for me, and whether I made it or not, it's just who I am. It's just part of me.
Michael may have cried a couple of times during the interview segments. Fun to say this, it was an emotional ride.
As well he should.
I mean, literally, when you're staring at the checkered flag at the Daytona 500, and you're, let's say, 200 yards off start-finish, and you're seeing the checkered flag after 462 races of not winning, and you're seeing that as that's happening, your best buddy and team driver is dying behind you simultaneously. That's this story. I mean,
who else has the best and worst day on the same day?
It narrowed down to seconds.
At the same time.
Seconds.
It almost doesn't seem real.
Yes. I mean, that was the timing of this thing. Michael, I highly recommend this thing. It's in select theaters in New York and Los Angeles as we speak. It's going to get a wider release on Thursday, September 12th. You can also check out Michael's podcast, Wall Trip Unfiltered, and the website, blinkofaneyefilm.com, is where you should go. I highly recommend it.
I appreciate that. It's good talking to y'all, and thanks for the time, and I appreciate your endorsement of the film. I'm really happy with it. I think it's done, like you said, it's a hard story to tell, but it's told perfectly.
Thank you, Michael Waltrip. Yeah, it's a really, it's crazy. Yeah. It's a crazy story.
And we've talked about, you know, how height plays a factor, and you're a little tall, you know, for some of those cars. He's 6'5", is that right?
He's definitely, yeah.
6'5".
he's tall when the car gets destroyed. I'm telling you, be Kevin Hart. All right.
Can do.
Also, in the racing doc department, I just got news from Nate that I think Ford v. Ferrari, the Matt Damon, Christian Bale. Matt Damon is Christian Bale's Ken Miles. Matt Damon is Carroll Shelby. We got the Shelby doc finishing coming out. I think November 1st, maybe a little shaky on the dates, I shall be interviewing both of them.
Oh, good. As you should.
For the pod and their movie as well. Yes, November 1st. So that'll be upcoming, and that'll be good.
Nice.
I imagine you'll want Brian and I there for that.
Yeah, because we're talking cars and I don't want to keep saying thingamajigger.
Yeah.
When who's it, what's it?
Yeah, when
the
I mean like after cooler or intercooler or
outer cooler.
We don't want you to look stupid.
I don't want to be stupid. And someone's going to have, and we're talking boost, you got to convert it to bar, and I can't do the
we
whole
know,
metric
sweetie.
Thing.
Yeah. You ought to know a lot about the under parts, right? See, those questions wouldn't flow.
So we got that coming up. That'll be interesting. Bo's here. Good. I'm ready to be motivated. First, betonline.ag NFL Weekly Pick'em Charity Contest is coming up. Are you ready for some football, man? It's officially happening. Week one, NFL kickoff. Looking for a place to make some online wagers? Head to betonline.ag. Take advantage of the best bonuses in the business. Huge matchups. Week one, Green Bay, Chicago. That's a good uniform matchup right there.
Yeah, classic.
Atlanta, Minnesota. Another strong uniform matchup. Rams, Carolina. Yeah, depends on the uniform. Pittsburgh, New England. That's good if New England would go throwback.
Yeah.
Anyway, lots of good games going on this first week, big matchups. We got a $500 in rewards to give out each week for five listeners and add a $5,000 season-long charity contest so you can join the conversation on Twitter with hashtag SportNetChallenge. SportNetChallenge, and you can talk with the experts. Brian, what do you think? We got feelings?
Yeah, you and I are doing the contest, right? So if we win, our listeners win. So it behooves us to not pick the same games as everyone else. So I went a little off the board. I got the Cardinals as home dogs over the Lions, Jets over Bills, Eagles at home over the Redskins, Ravens on the road over the Dolphins, and the Browns at home over the Titans.
Like to see the Browns do well. Aren't we all kind of rooting for the Browns?
I would like to see, yes. I have no dog in that fight. I just want to see those fans finally get some.
The one hole in my game is I never know the leagues, which is the Browns can't play the Patriots in the Super Bowl.
No, they play in the AFC Championship.
Okay. But let's just say I had a magic wand.
Okay. All right. I'm with you.
First off, use the promo code PODCAST1 and receive a 50% sign-up bonus today. BetOnline.ag. Magic wand. And I swear to God this would happen. If the Browns played the Patriots in the Super Bowl this year, and I had a Super Bowl party, and I walked around and talked to random people who weren't from New England and weren't from Cleveland, I could find half of them that were rooting for the Patriots. And I'd go, but why?
Right.
But why? This guy's married to a supermodel, and he has seven rings, and they've never been to the Super Bowl. Yeah. And they go, I like the Patriots. It would drive me nuts. That person, like if I see a person litter or kick a dog or answer that way at a Super Bowl party, I have no time for them. I hate them.
Cleveland, the most up there with the most tortured sports cities of all time, or at least the last 50 years. Boston, up there with the most blessed sports cities of the last few decades.
You would, I swear to God, if they could play each other and there was a Super Bowl party, you would find random people who had no dog in the fight, didn't bet, didn't say, oh, I'm from Gardena. I've never even been out of Los Angeles. And they would be rooting for the Patriots. That drives me insane. Is that a weakness in their part?
Is that them going,
I think they're going to win, so I'm going to root for them?
Yeah, I hope that's not the reason. I hope it's something else. You know, I know nothing.
I
hope it's something stupid, like I know Tom Brady's face or I know the name.
All right. I'm angry.
Please tell me you saw it. This is my extent of football knowledge. The new commercial for the Browns Color Rush uniforms.
Oh, no.
With what's his name singing? You are so beautiful.
To me.
Louis Armstrong?
No.
Joe Cocker?
Oh, yes.
Joe Cocker.
It's a Joe Cocker world. It's a very, very funny promo for their Color Rush uniforms. Not that anybody cares about that but me.
Well, speaking of football, former NFL safety and playwright. And, speaking of the Patriots.
Yeah.
His brother started a Super Bowl for the Patriots. Tony. Was it Tony Eason? Lowest rated quarterback in a Super Bowl.
Be sure to bring that up.
Pulled him after 6 incompletions, I guess, and probably put Steve Grogan in there.
I think it sounds about right, yeah.
We'll try it. But no one stood a chance against the Bears' defense that year.
Okay.
Oh, and Gina, just for a big picture thing, before the Tom Brady era, New England Patriots were a Cleveland Browns-esque. Actually, Cleveland had some good years. Like they were what Cleveland is today.
Biggest mistake I've ever made as an adult is when the Patriots beat my Rams for their first Super Bowl, and I thought, okay.
Good for them.
Good for them, because the Rams had won a year before that. Or
they're the greatest show on
whatever. No. And the Patriots had been snake bit and were literally embarrassed by the Bears in that Super Bowl. And I was like, good for you.
Let them get one.
Yes, that's what I thought. As a Rams fan, I thought, good
Look
for
what
you.
What you've done.
Yes.
I said they were blessed. If not for a Drew Bledsoe sheared blood vessel, this whole Tom Brady era never would have happened.
Well, yeah.
All right. And many dubious calls. All right. Bo Eason will be in here right after this.
Just $25, you get wine and gifts. Ace's favorite stuff or products from ACS. Every single month, you get the drink you choose. It's hard to beat cool stuff and booze. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut. Adam's Monthly Nut.
Month 4 of Adam's Monthly Nut is sold out. Too bad you missed out on the gifts in this month's sack. But don't worry, there's still a way to get crazy gonuts and dude wipes delivered right to your doorstep. Head to dudewipes.com and use the promo code ADAM20 for 20% off your order. Head to crazygonutswalnuts.com for 20% off everything in store, excluding case orders through September. Thanks to our sponsors for joining month 4, and stay tuned. The month 5 announcement is right around the corner. There may be a golden ticket inside. It's time to check Adam's voicemail.
Hey, Adam. No fucking around. I just bought my childhood home to fix up and sell. My childhood home with my one super that I was raised in by my one super neglectful parent. As such, my kitchen's not real functional at the moment. So I stopped at a local burrito joint here in Dayton, Ohio, and it turns out they have a Monday burrito special going on. So I went ahead and pulled the Dawson and bought 6 of those fuckers.
You can leave us a message at 888-634-1744.
Bo Eason in studio, ex-NFLer, ex-safety, played, 5, 6 years in the league?
5 years, yeah.
I stumbled on to Bo when I was speaking to Kevin Hench, and he's a friend of ours. Kevin was explaining that he went out to like a motivational symposium you were doing, and
yeah.
He was very excited about it. Seemed the funny conversation I had with Hench is he was more into your wife.
Everybody is.
Not sexually. He was like, Bo's wife was there. She was setting up the tables. She was putting the books up. She was getting everything in order. She was there early setting up everything. And then he paused and he went, my wife would never do that. And I said, are you fucking high? My wife would never do that, too. What's up with Bo's wife?
It's so true.
She's at the event. She's setting things up. She's ushering people around.
Yeah, she's here right now.
I know.
She's moving and shaking as we speak.
She just herded me into the studio.
Yeah, that's right. Most people who work with me, I always ask them when we become friends,
later, years later, and I'll say, why do you work with me? And they go, oh, it's you're cool, but it's your wife. Every yeah, time.
That's what Andrew's saying. So he loved your message, and the book is called There's No Plan B for Your A Game. Be the best in the world at what you do. Let's talk about that. What does that mean? How do we get there?
Yeah, that the title stems from when I was a kid. Me and my brother both had dreams of playing pro football, but we didn't know any pro football players. Our high school never had a pro athlete of any kind in 100 years, and not since we left either. But we had these dreams, right? So these parents of our teammates who were actually better than us in high school would come over to the house, to my mom and dad's house, right? And so we lived on a ranch. My dad's a cowboy. And these parents would come in and they go, hey, you know, Bo and Tony have these dreams, but we don't know any NFL players and the odds of that happening aren't good. So how about we put together a plan B for them or a fallback plan? And literally, my mom is like a grizzly bear, right? So I'm the youngest of six kids. And so when somebody has a doubt like that, like, you know, is probably trying to be helpful and go, hey, how about a plan B for these kids so they don't have a broken heart? My mom literally physically would grab them and take them to the front door and throw them on the porch and slam the door. And,
wow.
And these were her best friends. never to be seen again. And right then, me and my brother, I mean, we were kids, right, with these like dreams and these plans. And when you watch your mom, you know, who's cool, a cool lady, she's still alive, she's 89, do that, you go, oh, man, I guess these dreams are, she's taking them seriously. Yeah. Maybe we should, too.
You better, yeah.
And so that is when we got rid of any fallback plan, any plan B, and it worked out, right?
Well, football is a very difficult sport to will yourself into. Golf, tennis, baseball, you have a much better chance of working. You know, you go, look, you'll just do the repetitions in baseball. You take a lot of batting practice or you do a lot of whatever that is. Football has a, you know, bunch of guys like Bo Jackson in it, and you're not going to outrun Bo Jackson. You're not going to outlift him. You're not going to out anything. But football's filled with specimens, crazy specimens. You know, the thing about football that you don't really realize is you grow up and you might know some big dudes, and then you know some fast dudes, but they're small. When you get to football to that level, you run into big fast dudes. And that's crazy when you see these Christian Okoye types or whatever, these massive dudes who can scoot and have balance and they're graceful. So that took a lot of will to get for you and your brother to get to that level, because there's so much of a physicality. And so you have to outwork everyone. And even if you outwork everyone, it's probably not going to work.
But. Yeah. That's exactly what we did. You know, we're the youngest. So we have four older sisters and then Tony and I. And so there was no, of course, phone. You know, we didn't have any reception for our TV. We had three channels and those weren't good. So all we did was throw the football. So that was how we related. That's how we talked. That's how we were brothers. And he's a year older than me. And he would throw. And I would catch, and he would throw, and I would catch. And we made up this thing where we'd do it 1,000 balls a day. And so I remember my dad – I remember this incident happening in Beverly Hills when we lived here, right? So when I married Dawn, my wife that is so well-known, when we got married, we lived in Beverly Hills initially, and we started having kids, right? So we would go to these birthday parties with these, you know, other kids from Beverly Hills. I didn't grow up there. And – my son, Axel, was about 2.5 at the time. Now he's 12. And he found a football at this little birthday party for these little Beverly Hills kids, right? Little preschool. Mm-hmm. So Axel finds this ball and he wants to play catch. So we start playing catch and I throw Axel the ball and he dropped it. And I go, Axel, and he's 2.5. I go, Axel, don't let the ball touch the ground. And he goes, oh, yeah, Dad. Oh, yeah, got it. Picks it back up and we start playing catch. Well, these entertainment agents and these entertainment lawyers who are all the dads of all the other kids come walking over to me and they say, what did you just say to that boy? And I said, that boy's my son. And I told them, don't let the ball touch the ground. And they go, how could you say, what? Who are you to say that to this boy? And I go, that boy's my son. And I say that because that's a rule in our house. We don't let the ball touch the ground. And they're like, how would that, how could that be a rule in your house? Who makes up these rules? I go, it's a rule in my house because it was a rule in my house when I was growing up. My dad got us a football every Christmas, right? So if you have to catch that ball and throw that ball 1,000 times a day, you don't let it touch the ground because it's not going to last till next Christmas and we weren't getting a new one. So me and my brother figured out that if he threw it and I caught it and it never touched the ground for a year, we'd get a new football at Christmas. Which then, if you think about it, took us all the way to the NFL. My brother, you know, quarterback, first round pick to New England, and me as safety, who has to catch the ball, to the Houston Oilers. That's how it worked out. And here's what's so crazy about it. That's a rule in my house now. Like, that's how I raise my kids. Just with that kind of standard, which is a lot of what I've done with my kids and what was done with me is in the book, actually.
My dad had a rule, which is he had a wallet, but you could never open it. You never open it.
That included
no
him.
No, open that wallet.
That wallet can't touch your hands.
Rules to live by.
Yeah, I know. People are so goddamn worried about kids, and especially young boys, and like what you're telling them. Those kids, young boys, are the most resilient creatures on the planet. They process everything. It's all fine. Their bones heal quick. Their mind heals quick. You can get them in 1,000 headlocks. People have no idea what young boys should experience. They try to protect them. When you try to protect them, you end up with the same shit you have with Purell and peanuts. Your job is keep all the peanuts away from the young kid. Well, what happens? The fucking chickens come home to roost. Now all the kids have allergies. You're injuring the kids by bathing them in Purell and keeping them away. You're also injuring the kids by not letting them get injured, not letting them wrestle, not letting them roughhouse, not letting them be aggressive, not let them understand which kids can. I knew the kids not to fuck with, and then I knew the kids I could fuck with.
That's right.
You have to learn. That kid will kick your ass. That kid won't.
That's right.
And where do you fall into this pecking order?
Yeah.
Everyone just has to sit somewhere and play some fucking Foursquare or some chick game or something. And then we wonder why all the fucking guys are miserable. And they're not only miserable, they're fucking horrible.
I mean, what are you talking about?
Fucking talk to a 19-year-old guy? You can't even fucking talk to him anymore. They're fucking useless.
Yeah.
And we're not preparing. We're setting them up for failure. Well, they will fail.
Back to the adulting thing. Now, like, accomplishing basic, not even basic, rudimentary tasks, like entry-level to life tasks is like, oh, I adulted today.
It's so fucking sad.
And that same kid, Axel, who was 2.5 when we set this rule in place and got accosted by the agents and lawyers. Axel's now 12, right? So he's the quarterback of his middle school team, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I go out there to practice, you know, and try to help as much as I can. And some kids will go like this. Even dads will go, even relatives will at holiday go, Axel, hey, man, throw me that football over here. And Axel goes like this, no. Because he knows the ball's going to end up on the ground.
Yeah.
Oh,
he knows there's
can't
no
take that risk.
There's no standard, so there's no. He's not giving him the ball.
Wow.
He's like, you're more D-line material.
Right. It's like playing keep away with somebody, you know? And they're relatives at Thanksgiving.
The football, such an important experience for men, boys, whoever. Yeah. You know, just the fact that we're trying to weed out the football. One more tough step. I mean, I've always said, you know, because then I played 7 years of Pop Warner, which is like the most Pop Warner football anyone can ever math. No, you can only tie 7 years. You can never beat 7 years because the way it worked out here is you started at 7, went to 14 or 15, and then just went to high school after that. I got jacked up all the time. We had crazy mean coaches all the time. We had scary mean dudes, man. You didn't fuck around with Mr. Fitzgerald. And we had a lot of these guys, and they would be like, they'd grab you by the face mask. Mr. Fitzgerald was like, look, you guys are nine. I don't, anyone who thinks they should be starting, because football sucks when you don't start, because football practice is goddamn miserable. Right. You know this heat right now? Mm-hmm. You know what's going on right now? Football.
Two fucking football
practice in this heat.
And if you need water, you're weak.
They thought water was bad for you.
That's right. You'll cramp
up. Just rinse it and spit it. Come on, you'll cramp up. You'll get soft.
Water will cause cramps. That was the science.
To be fair, it was two-step crazy gypsy thought. One is, you're fucking running wind sprints in this heat in full gear, and the water will be bad for you, number one. But number two, it makes you soft.
Yeah, if you have water, you're weak.
We want tough guys. Yeah, right. We want guys, you gotta rise above.
Crying for water.
A little intestinal fortitude.
Because that was a fourth quarter effort. If you were tired and need water in the fourth quarter.
I have a deviated septum, so I was a mouth breather. So I was like.
And you got the mouthpiece in.
And you can't breathe.
And
you got grass in your mouth from doing up and downs and everything. And we'd have to go out and practice in this weather in full gear. I would have these fantasies about, like, I'm going to bury some water. I'd go, I'm going to go out there the night before. I'm going to dig a hole, and I'm going to get a jar, and I'm going to put water in it, and I'm going to bury it. It was so crazy. They wouldn't give you water.
Like Bugs Bunny having the hallucination of the mirage.
The oasis.
No, the oasis in the middle of the desert. Yeah. That's what it is. Like, yes, I'm going to bury some water. I'm going to break a hose.
Yeah, you thought like an old prospector.
I know. And they wouldn't let you have water, and they would kill you, and we go nuts. But the point is if you practiced a full week and then you didn't start in the game, it was like, the most miserable thing you could do, because it's like the practice sucked and it was horrible, and then you just go sit on the bench. So Mr. Fitzgerald, to anybody who was on the defensive side of the ball or any interior lineman, just pretty much anything but a quarterback or a running back, he'd go, hey, if you think you're better than that guy and that guy's starting above you, then call him out. Line it up, and let's go for it.
Can you imagine that happening today? I mean, look, these kids, when I'm out there helping, with coaching, we'll put them on the line, and we'll say, hey, we're going to run some wind sprints. And some kids will just go, nah, I don't think so. I remember just being petrified.
You get to say no?
Right, yeah. You say no to your coach. Where I always remember being petrified of my coach. Like, I just wanted to please him, the whole time.
It was, first off, I didn't know anyone's first name. I only knew their last names. That's all. Everyone's just called by their last name.
Yeah.
Coach wasn't even called coach. It was like Mr. Fitzgerald, Mr. Gallagher, Mr. whoever. I still remember a lot of these guys. And that was it. Here's how last namey they were. My sister came to a practice once, and somebody went up to say, one of the kids like said hi to her, and he called her Carolla's sister.
Yeah. Okay.
That's how unfirst namey everyone was. Yes, sir, no, sir, and military style, basic torture.
The good old days.
Yeah, and a lot of shaming, a ton of shaming, lining everybody up, Mr. Fitzgerald. You got to find that picture of East Valley Trojans. Mr. Fitzgerald was about 275 pounds, had a big beard, big 70s like hair and beard and windbreaker and everything. And he just like line everybody up, and he'd be like, all right, line it up, and get everyone getting a stance, and he'd hold the ball out in front, and he'd go, all right, you guys are on the defensive side of the ball, and you look at that ball. You don't move until that ball moves, man. And he'd hold that ball, and he'd go like, hit, hut, hut. And at some point, like, Higginstaller would like lurch forward, and he'd go, all right, everyone's running a lap. Everyone's on a lap. And you can thank Higginstaller. Thank Higginstaller. And he'd be like, God damn it, Higginstaller. You can thank Higginstaller for that lap. Everyone's running.
You had to be accountable to the group. And they always did it at the end of practice when you were dehydrated and tired and mentally fatigued.
I bet they don't even call them ladies anymore.
Oh, my God.
What's this world coming to?
That was Mr.
Take a knee, ladies.
Mr. Gallagher's daughter was on the gymnastics gymnastics team, and Coach Gallagher would, we'd be doing push-ups, and they're like, you know, I'd be doing 30, and your guy's arms would be shaking. He'd be like, my daughter, Kelly, she's in the gymnastics team. They do 50 push-ups. She got girls doing push-ups. Don't give me that Higginstaller. Like, he shamed the shit again. Out of everybody.
She's 105 pounds and does the pommel horse.
Yes.
So they, she's a great athlete.
They'd shame the shit out of everyone. They would torture you. Yeah. It was, by the way, we were 10. It was fine. It was fine. Yeah. Fine with us.
I played football for 2 years poorly, but I remember one thing so vividly. I never told the story before. So the coach would do the thing where you hold the football, line you all up, and go on the snap of the football, right? You go, hut! And I'm holding it like out in front of me. Hut! 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 You try and fool you. And you're mentally fatigued. You're tired. You're thirsty. You've been beaten up all practice, but you're supposed to, you know, concentrate on that ball, right? And we were all doing it. And of course, you know, every once in a while, a guy would lurch and you'd have to do the push-ups or the laps or whatever. And one time, he goes, hut! He didn't move the ball. And Johnny Heckenberg, who was a running back,
Heckenberg.
he leaned forward, and before the coach could like send us all on a lap, he goes, I'm in motion. And he goes, that's using your head, Heckenberg. That's the smartest thing Johnny Heckenberg ever said. I'm in motion.
I got to use that. That's
genius.
Is pretty smart.
That was the smartest thing I've ever heard.
That's pretty good.
Well, now there's a picture of me with Mr.
Is that you right there with the shoulder pads?
Yeah, that's me, but that's Mr. Gallagher. It's Duke Gallagher. His little blonde daughter's in front of him.
Is that
she was on the gymnastics team.
She's knocking out push-ups real quick.
This would have been a team picture of the East Valley Trojans, but that is Duke Gallagher and his little daughter,
Kelly. But Adam, what about your undershirt? What color is that?
I had...
I got mixed in with some other ones.
For the red sock.
I had this weird... look, first off, there's no Under Armour or anything of that nature, and if there was, the Corollas wouldn't... Remember the wallet never opened. I had a weird, purpley, kind of funky shirt, and at some point, I just decided it was my lucky shirt, and I did intentionally wear this weird, purple undershirt on game day. Like, I just had this. That's my shirt I wear underneath my pads for the East Valley Trojans.
It's like Barry Bonds wearing the earring. It's like, how much of a badass must he be to be wearing that one earring?
That's right. I mean, no one could see my purple shirt when I had that jersey on.
Look at that field behind you. I was just telling my son the other day, I go, you know, the thing you're always going to miss your whole life is you're never going to have a grass stain or dirt or mud all over you and play football.
Or the middle of the field that's torn up. That one section where you always practiced and always played.
Yep. They all play
between
on
the hash marks.
This fake grass now.
Yeah, we're now looking at the team picture. Mr. Fitzgerald is the tall guy. I don't think this one, he has his beard going on this one, but you can blow it up. He's to the right.
A little bit of a Rainn Wilson vibe.
He's got a tall,
this picture.
Yeah, these guys would just yell at you. The other good move they would do, too, is they'd give you...
That's Dwight Schrute. I'm sorry.
I'm looking at Mr. Fitzgerald. He doesn't have his beard in this picture, but is a good one. These guys, they put you in that three-point stance. They go, get in your three-point stance. You get in a three-point stance, and they just walk up to you, and they kick your front... your arm out. They just kick your arm out, and you fall on your face. They go, you got too much weight on your hand.
Yeah, it's evenly distributed amongst three limbs.
So imagine any of this shit going
awesome.
Down.
Oh.
I know, but also, when you hear about people explaining, male, female, whatever, young, old, whatever, when you hear adults, it's just like adult dudes, like 40-year-old dudes going, I felt threatened by the MAGA hat, whatever it is, you're like, what the fuck are you talking? You felt threatened? Like, you've never been through anything. You've never seen anything. How do you feel that way? I never feel that way ever.
Right. No, you've already been through it.
It's get the shit kicked out of you so often that you just never, nothing registers anymore.
Yeah. I think it should be like mandatory, like have every kid go through at least a training camp, right?
Of course.
Or like a military type camp so that you at least get, you know, see what you're, measure yourself. Check out, see who you are. Because, you're never going to face anything tougher than that. And at the age of 10, certainly not. And then by the time you're 40, like you said, you got guys all, you know, worried about being, you know, offended. And these guys were offended that I was saying, don't let the ball touch the ground. That was all I was saying.
I don't even, first off, I don't know that you have the right to be offended. That's not even a possibility for me.
Excuse me, Adam, that's my truth.
I've never been offended. I think some people are assholes, and other people don't know what the fuck they're talking about. But I'm not offended. Not even really in. I don't have that setting. Why do you even have that setting? There's people you go, I disagree with that person, or I don't want to be with that person. And then there are other people, we like Kevin Hench. Okay, yeah. I'll hang out with Kevin Hench. But it's not like I'm offended and I must compose. I got to write a letter now and like send it to somebody. First off, isn't your time precious? What do you spend so much time being offended? That's your life, mm-hmm. isn't it?
No, yeah. It's just building up a case against themselves, their victimhood.
How does one be the best in the world at what you do?
You know what? I've done this like four times in my life where I make a declaration. The first one I did was when I was 9 years old. And I just declared I wanted to be the best safety in the world. And I still have it. It's a like 50-year-old piece of paper. But it's literally looks like the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. I just wrote and I drew a picture of me intercepting a ball.
It's in the book. Is that correct?
There's a picture of it in the book. And I declared that that's what I wanted to be, the best safety in the world. Now, you know, the whole way for 18 years trying to get there looked impossible. Mm-hmm. I mean, I didn't have any
tall order.
Yeah, right? And then there was no college scholarships. No one wanted me. I walked on at UC Davis, which doesn't even give scholarships, you know, and doesn't – it's not like it's a football factory. But ended up being one of the top safeties taken in 1984.
I'll tell you how you know it's not a football factory. I got recruited to play football at UC
really?
Davis. Were they the Aggies?
The Aggies. That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And then my roommate, actually, when I was at Davis.
There's a beard.
There's Mr. Fitzgerald with
very
the beard.
Oh,
yeah. And check out the gent next to Mr. Fitzgerald. This guy's another hoss with a big beard. These guys didn't fuck around, man. They got into this to scream at 8-year-olds. There's no doubt in my mind.
What do I love doing and how can I get paid for it?
No mercy. Yeah, sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry. Well, we'll put the pictures up at adamcarolla.com, but you guys will have a laugh about it.
Yeah.
Anyway.
That's good. Yeah. So I just, it's always worked out for me if I just make a declaration and just live into it instead of goal setting where you have a big to-do list, you have a bunch of things to fulfill on. I just thought of it like the Declaration of Independence. I didn't know the guys who wrote that, right, 250 years ago, but yet I walk around fulfilling on their writings every day, the way I move freely through this world of ours, and that's what I do. I just make declarations. I want to be – and I always include the word the best only because that's how my dad woke us up. You know, he would just wake us all up, all six of us at 5 a.m, and he would say, you're the best in there. God damn it, you're the best. Wow. And for 18 years until I left that room, that's how I was woken up. And then my sisters too and my brothers too.
What?
And like – And we would go – we would also – my brothers – when we got old enough, we would go on double dates, right, like with these girls. And my dad would walk us out to the car.
You're the best.
With the – yes. And he would go, now, God damn it, boys, you're the best. And these girls – I mean, this is their first day, like 15, 16 years old. They're just looking at him like, I don't know what this guy's doing. And my brother would go, Dad – go back in the house, you know, don't say that. He would say it at Little League. He would broadcast it.
The dad of the dates would be yelling to the daughters, don't let the panties hit the ground. Not getting you new panties.
Not until next Christmas.
Well, all right.
If you bring these back unused.
what's driving me insane in the current culture is all the victimhood that's going on and all the politicians who have essentially – the politicians – I look at them like the doctors who write fake notes for dumb people to take their dogs on an airplane. They don't like dogs or like airplanes. It's just like they figured out, hey, I can make money. Mm-hmm. People go online. I'll charge them $55 a pop. I'm a doctor. And then someone goes, hey, man, you're a doctor. What are you doing this shit for? And they go, it's $55 a pop. That's what politicians are. They're just like, I don't have any thoughts. If I can get more votes calling this group a victim, then I'll just say they're victim and I'll just get more votes. I don't know what they believe. I don't know what they look. I don't even blame them. They just they're sort of they lack character. But that's what they want to do. But there's many people and many. Well, how many fucking attorneys lack character? How many doctors? Like, I mean, everyone lacks character. Fine. Why are we buying into this?
Right.
And how much is it devastating the communities that we're turning into victims? And then why am I the bad guy when I'm explaining you're not a victim?
Right. Exactly.
That's the fucking, that's the hypocrisy
of
it.
Or even if you have standards. So, you know, when you're at that party and you're saying don't let the ball touch the ground, and that's offensive to people because they have no standards.
Or they just don't,
they don't respect the ball or the sport or the game. Or the competition of it.
I'll circle back to Kevin Hinch. When I met Kevin, I was like, this guy's not the funniest guy I know. He's the smartest, hardest working guy I know. Mm-hmm. And the reason he now has two super successful multi-cam sitcoms, one on Netflix and one on Fox, which is a pretty tall order, is because he fucking outworks everybody.
Yep.
And he doesn't really take no for an answer.
Yep.
And the good news is if you live in the United States and it's 2019, there's no better place to do that. On the other hand, if you want to have your head filled with a bunch of politicians explaining you why it's not working out, and how could you possibly get ahead in the field tilted, whatever, then you won't. That's it.
Yep.
I don't know that there are no other answers, people. I don't know what you want from these people who are telling you you can't. By the way, they don't have a solution. They're just telling you you can't succeed.
Right.
And the solution is vote for them, and then it'll work out.
Right.
Oh, okay, vote for Maxine Waters. She'll be in charge for another 100 years, and then go find your constituency, and you tell me how it's working out.
Yep.
It never works out.
Yep.
There's only one answer. I don't get why people don't. Why don't people know this?
Yeah.
Why isn't it? It's patently true. It's obvious. It's like gravity. It's like,
yep.
why are so many people so soft?
Yep.
Why do they listen to everybody? Have there not been enough examples of people? Like when they talk about like, well, but as a woman, there's no examples. There's no Oprahs. There's not a kajillion examples of every race and every type and everything succeeding. Gay, straight, confined to a wheelchair? Are there not thousands and hundreds and millions of examples of that happening before this time?
Yep.
What the fuck is everyone buying into this for?
Exactly. I was on stage the other day on somebody else's stage, right? So it's their audience. And I said the word, I said the term hard work. And I said it maybe 3 or 4 times during the speech. When I walked off stage, the host, the guy, came up to me and goes, hey, man, you can't say that. Yeah. And I go, wait a sec, what? And I go, he goes, because we've pulled that word, and that word our audience does not like.
Yeah,
because they don't want to do any more work. They've
right.
got enough work. I'm like, okay, so I'm telling them how to be the best, and they've got to work the hard. They got to outwork mm-hmm. everybody, just like Kevin, just like anybody who's reached anything in their lives. You've got to outwork everybody and just not take no for an answer. That's the only way, which is a reason why I wrote this book, because so much mediocrity is just like coming at you. And then once my kids got to be school age, then you really see it. And I moved out of Beverly Hills just because of that. I can't be around that mediocre mindset or that your standard offends me. And I'm not going to be around it. I'm not going to have my kids around it. And so we just moved to a section of town that's a little more tolerant of greatness. You know?
Oh, God, I got to know.
Put this right? on the signs.
Now with more greatness.
Right.
Now I got to know what neighborhood you're in.
Yeah.
Yeah. We live out in like Westlake Village.
Oh,
and
yeah. Hills, so. All right. Yeah.
West Valley guy.
We get it.
Yeah. Yeah,
tolerant of greatness.
Yes.
It is crazy. I do also like when you're like preaching focus and discipline and hard work and family and education, and they're like, he's got a lot out there.
A lot of woo-woo.
He's got a lot of crazy thoughts out there, and they're pretty controversial.
Yeah.
We disagree with a lot. You know, we don't agree on everything. I mean, you're a nice guy, but you come in here with your smoking hokum and your flat earther. It's like, are you fucking nuts? I'm telling you the only thing that works. Why is this controversial? Or he's got thoughts. We don't agree with those thoughts. You're going to argue with my thoughts.
Yep.
Are you fucking nuts?
Yep.
Jesus Christ. And then they want you to kind of like back down, like, whoa, 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 slow it down with your crazy thoughts about family and education and dads raising kids and discipline and hard work. Just slow your roll.
Yeah.
What about other things? What about the school to prison pipeline? It's like, well, shut up. Jesus Christ. It's insane.
It is.
The insane thing is that these fucksticks are employed. That's the insane part. Mm-hmm. That I got to go on fucking Huffington Post and argue with these fucking nut jobs. That's the scary part. Yep. And the other part is no one is telling them to shut the fuck up. Yep. They're nuts. This is insane. There's only one path to success. It involves hard work. If you don't want to do it, then fine. You don't want to do it. But stop eating snack wells and drinking diet right. That's not a diet. That's not health. This is a version of that. I get it. Everyone wants cake. That's not a diet. And you removing the calories from cake doesn't work.
Right.
You just have to fucking do it.
Yep.
There's no different in this part of life and in diet. There's no difference. You're allowed cheat days, but overall, big picture, you got to exercise, you got to change your diet, and you can't fucking walk around it. You're not going to outsmart nature.
100%. And that's funny you should say nature, because a lot of people go, like, sometimes when I'm doing interviews or talking to people about what it takes to be the best, and they always push back and they go, oh, well, that's too hard, or that. I go, you know how. It's so much easier to be the best in the world at what you do than to be mediocre, because you're actually made that way. Mother Nature made you. Mm. You won the first race you ever entered, you know, against 300 million to one odds. You outswam all those other sperm.
Yeah. Right.
Sure. You've born number one. And now you're born into a world where we're supposed to accept mediocrity. It's much harder to be mediocre than it is to be the best. It's how we're made. And now we got to invent a whole language and a whole lifestyle to fulfill our mediocre lifestyle instead of just aiming to be the best, which is what we were born to do in the first place. It's so much more natural. It's so much going with Mother Nature instead of flying in the face with her, which our whole society, which most men do. They just fly directly in the face of their own nature and pretend that they're mediocre. And pretend that they're like half-assed. And even the people I respect the most, like a true competitor, which I would think would be an elite athlete or a race car driver or a gymnast, but an elite athlete. And when I start to see them beg for victimhood or try to get attention by being a victim instead of a competitor, or not want to compete. Like if you watch the NBA, for example, you notice how these guys are supposed to be the ultimate competitors, and what they actually do is not compete. They join the same team. Mm-hmm. They don't want to compete. Wow. So I, like in my day, in your day, when you got Larry Bird and Magic Johnson, those, and Kobe and Jordan, do you think those guys would ever join each other?
Right.
No, they want to kill each other. They want to compete. And here goes basketball goes straight up. Now basketball goes straight down because, hey, let's be chums. Let's ask less of ourselves and not compete so much and join all together so we can win.
You can work half as hard.
You can work. You have to. You're demanding less of yourself, which is unheard of in the athletic world. Yet that's what our greatest athletes are doing right now, which is why I wrote the book. I go, I'm not. That's bullshit. That they will not compete. There's a chapter in there that's called Re-Compete. We have to learn how to compete again and know that it's not a bad word. I mean, how many times?
Yeah, the competition. I was around when this started.
Right.
Guess who doesn't like competition? Lazy fucking losers.
Yep.
And they've decided competition was basically synonymous with aggression. Mm. And here's how you build a bridge when you're a lazy fucking loser. I come from these people. They go, competitive people, oh, that's aggressive. Oh, we don't want our boys to be aggression. Yeah. Negative. We don't want our boys to be aggressive. Tone it down. Tone it down.
Yep.
So when you tone down the aggressiveness, you also lose the competition. And then we're all sitting in the same And, Stew.
And the sport goes down. And
yes.
the manhood goes down. If there's no competition, there's – like I find that funny sometimes when businesses hire you and go, you have to sign a non-compete.
Mm-hmm.
You can't compete. I'm like, don't we live in America where we compete? Mm-hmm. That way everything gets better? And I always like, don't – you're asking a competitor not to compete. That's
crazy. Go find another line of work.
Right.
All right. Look, the turning – turning any creature into a victim, you turn anybody into a victim, you have hobbled that person. You might as well give them cancer. You have injured that person. You've done more harm to that person than any motorcycle accident could do. If you convince them they are a victim, there shall be no progress and there shall be no success from anyone who thinks they're a victim. And the politicians that are working overtime convincing everyone they're a victim, this started about 10 minutes ago, should be brought up on manslaughter charges. It is so fucking dangerous. It ruins entire cultures. It's a disaster, and people got to start pushing back against it. And the problem is if you stand up and explain you're not a victim, then they'll call you an oppressor.
Right.
Jesus, goddamn Christ. I mean, when I was on HuffPo and I was just telling that woman, just family and education, family and education. She was like, oh, come on. What about pollen? You know, like she was like, what about the school to prison pipe? What about? It's like, why are you fighting so hard? Mm-hmm. Why are you fighting so hard? Why not? Every group, your number one wish for any individual or any group that was falling behind would be family and education. If you had a magic wand and you could give it to any group or any individual, a kid that was struggling and you went, oh, that guy's dad's going to move back into the house. He's going to sober up. He's going to start parenting. They're going to double down on education and homework. That would be the best gift you could give an individual or a group. Pure and simple. Yep. No other discussions. Yep. Jesus Christ. Do we have her? Sorry. It just drives me nuts when she goes, oh, but come on.
He didn't give you a good answer as to perhaps what he thought maybe some of the systemic causes are that...
He had zero.
You know, leave minority groups in positions where they are more likely to live in poverty and...
I gave him the answer, which is family and education, and we can all get out of this mess. And he said it was much more complicated than that. But then,
what is a little more complicated than that, than just saying family and education?
Not much.
Oh, but come on. I mean, it's a system, right, where if you, it is much harder to get out of a certain income bracket if you're born into it. If you live in a certain neighborhood,
right.
that affects
but
the quality.
That's why you have to focus on family and education. But I mean, I'm not Christian or anything.
You're not going to solve everything.
It would solve everything, yeah.
Just family and education? What about, the drug war that we have that's failing? What about the school-to-prison pipeline, things like this?
The school-to-prison pipeline, if you focused on education, I think would interrupt the school-to-prison pipeline.
Well, the problem is that schools are maybe not focusing on education
okay.
so much.
Okay, just argue. Come on. Anything but work.
But that's
Jesus Christ. You're hurting the population,
right.
bitch.
Right.
Jesus Christ.
Exactly.
God damn. What are these people employed for? Yeah. We need to give you a job for what? So you can make up shit that doesn't exist? And what happened to the school-to-prison pipeline? Oh, it's gone. You guys got tired of talking about it 10 minutes ago. Now that's gone. Where are we at? No more school-to-prison pipeline? Trump, he's sucking off Putin. No, we're done with that. Oh, no, he's in the Klan. Okay, let's go. Okay.
That's a good sign.
Does it ever help? Does it ever do anything? Yes, you made up the school-to-prison pipeline. You talked about it for 4.5 years, and then you grew tired of it, and now you've moved on to your next thing to fucking yammer about.
Yep.
Meanwhile, the group you're trying to help is not being helped.
Mm-mm.
Okay, family and education. There's a suggestion. Yeah.
Mm. No. Got to work on a point shitting.
Zip it, Whitey. Jesus Christ. I mean, nuts. Oh, RJ Bell's on the phone? He's a white guy. Let me hit Geico here first. Let's see. Everyone's got the to-do list. You can, I knew Bo would get me fired up. Save hundreds of dollars on your car insurance, and you don't have to go anywhere. Just go to geico.com. 15 minutes, you could be saving 15% or more on your auto insurance. Take that extra money, put it in your pocket. Be the most rewarding thing you do all day. It is Geico. All right, RJ Bell's going to make a couple of picks. We'll put them up on the phone. We'll take a quick break. We'll do a little news or what have you right after this.